What is the most important role in the family? Is it mother or father? Sister or brother? Grandmother or grandfather? Dog or cat? According to Dr. Roma Hanks, professor and director of the gerontology program at the University of South Alabama in Mobile, it's grandparents. In Connecting the Generations, the New Role of Grandparents, she wrote, "It is my belief that grandparenting is the most important role in the new century." She explains, "I say that because grandparents are just now discovering all the possibilities of relating to their grandchildren, whether they are providing full-time care or working on a deeply supportive relationship. Grandparents will have influence over a longer period of their grandchildren's lives than ever before." Are grandparents really today finding a new role in life? Or are they rediscovering an ages-old position? It will take just a moment to show what Dr. Hanks calls the new role of grandparents is anything but new. After that, I'll continue to discuss the role of grandparents in the family and relate four lessons I've learned from my grandchildren, four ways that grandparents influence their grandchildren. God is all about family. The purpose of life is to prepare us to join God in an everlasting family. How we live today is preparation for life in the kingdom. Family and family history are very important to God. Many chapters throughout the Bible describe detailed family trees. Biblical lineages, or family trees, have great significance. An article, "What is the Relevance of the Genealogies in the Bible?" lists four. One, they help substantiate the Bible's historical accuracy by confirming the physical existence of the characters in the Bible. Two, they confirm prophecy, particularly Jesus' fulfillment of Isaiah 11:1, that the Messiah would descend from David. Three, they demonstrate the detail-oriented nature of God and his interest in individuals. They show a God involved. The inspired word mentions people by name, real people with real histories and real futures. And four, they provide insight into the lives of God's people. For example, Ruth and Rahab, although Gentile and not of the covenant people, are grafted into the messianic line. Biblical family trees or genealogies appear in many books of the Bible. They're important for what they say and for what they don't say. For example, consider Genesis 5, starting in verse 3. Adam became the father of a son, Seth. Seth became the father of Enosh. Enosh became the father of Kenan. The written word gives the names of the fathers and sons, but what is also implied? Grandparents. While Seth became the father of Enosh, Adam became a grandfather, and Eve became a grandmother. When Enosh became the father of Kenan, Adam became a great-grandfather, Eve became a great-grandmother, and Seth became a grandfather. Adam lived long enough to see eight generations of his family born. Adam died when his great-great-great-great-great-great grandson, Lamech, was 46 years old. From the beginning, God planned for families to be multi-generational. Dr. Hanks is just wrong when she writes that grandparents today have an opportunity that has never been before. Prior to the flood, BibleStudy.org says that the average lifespan was 857 years. That was an opportunity that has never been again. If families are designed by God to span more than one generation, what is the obligation of one generation to the next? Deuteronomy 6 answers that. Gary Petty, in a sermon entitled Family, said that this chapter is the most important chapter about family responsibility. Verse 1 begins, "These are the commands, decrees, and regulations the Lord your God commanded me to teach you. You must obey them in the land you are about to enter and occupy. You and your children and grandchildren must fear the Lord your God as long as you live. If you obey all his decrees and commands, you will enjoy a long life. Listen closely, Israel, and be careful to obey. Then all will go well with you, and you will have many children in the land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord, the God of your ancestors, promised." Verse 4, "Listen, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your strength. And you must commit yourselves wholeheartedly to these commands I'm giving you today." Verse 7, "Repeat them again and again to your children. Talk about them when you are at home and when you are on the road, when you are going to bed, and when you are getting up." God designed families to have God as the focus of their existence. God was to be the center of family life. Every life experience was to be a teachable moment about God. Families were to have a shared religious core, a way of life that would guide them through every thought and action. As history shows, that didn't happen. Overwhelmingly, the majority of people have no idea who God is or what he expects. But a few of us, because of the Holy Spirit living within us, have a rare opportunity. We can positively influence our children and grandchildren, whether they admit it now or not, just as God had intended. What is the most important role in the family? I have no idea. The Bible doesn't say. But if we applied the principle of 1 Corinthians 12, all family roles are important. Just as there are many parts to a body, but only one body, there are many parts to a family, but only one family. To paraphrase, God has put each member of the family just where he wants it. The father can never say to the mother, "I don't need you." The child can't say to the grandparent, "I don't need you." This makes for harmony among the members so that all the members care for each other. Each family position, whether parent, sibling, or grandparent, is strategic to a properly functioning family. For healthy families that allow grandparents to know and interact with their grandchildren, grandparents can play a key role in promoting a God-centered family. Arthur Kornheber, founder of the Foundation for Grandparents, believes that grandparents fill 11 roles in the family. Ancestor, a link between the present and the past. Buddy, a confidant and lighthearted conspirator. Hero, someone a grandchild looks up to. Historian, a storyteller. Mentor, a guide whose unconditional love makes a grandchild secure for who he is rather than how he performs. Nurturer, an emotional and social safety net for the entire family. Role model, a positive example of how to behave. Spiritual guide, a source of spiritual wonder about life. Student, open to learn new ideas from a grandchild. Teacher, a treasury of knowledge and skills and experience. And finally, wizard, not in a mystical way, but as a stimulator of a grandchild's imagination. As I discuss four lessons I've learned from my grandchildren, each of Dr. Kornheber's 11 roles of grandparents will either directly or indirectly be exemplified. The late Lois Wise, entrepreneur, columnist, author of more than 60 books, including Funny, You Don't Look Like a Grandmother, is credited with the adage, "If I had known how wonderful it would be to have grandchildren, I would have had them first." I agree with Mrs. Wise. Interactions with grandchildren are special. Proverbs 17:6 agrees too. The voice renders this verse as, Grandchildren are the crowning glory and ultimate delight of old age. Psalms 127:3 says that children are a gift from the Lord. As much as children are God's gift to parents, they're also a gift to grandparents. And as I will show, grandparents are a gift to grandchildren. To convey how delightful grandchildren can be, I've made the following 4 points for this sermon from statements of my two grandsons, Colton and Carson. Point number one is, do you celebrate Disneyland? Out of the clear blue, then 4-year-old Carson asked that question. Carson's 5 now. He and his brother Colton know that we're different than his family. He knows that, unlike his family, we don't observe birthdays, Christmas, New Year's, Valentine's, Easter, or Halloween. But he also knows that we do keep Passover, unleavened bread, Pentecost, trumpets, atonement, and the feast. So in his effort to try to find something in common that we all keep, he asked, "Do you celebrate Disneyland?" Currently his favorite thing in life. To me, the real significance of that question is, grandparents set an example for grandchildren. It might be a good example, it might be a bad example. But one way or another, every conversation and interaction sends a message. One of the best biblical examples of a positive influence from a grandparent is found in 2 Timothy 1:5. Paul praised Timothy's grandmother, Lois. In writing to Timothy, Paul said, "I'm reminded of how sincere your faith is, that faith first lived in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice. I'm convinced it also lives in you." According to Young's exhaustive concordance, this is the only use of the word grandmother in the Bible. Many commentators believe Lois, Eunice, and Timothy met Paul on his first missionary journey when Paul in Acts 14:6 taught in Lystra. When Paul returned 2 years later, he was so pleased with Timothy's knowledge and reputation that Paul enjoined Timothy to accompany him on the second missionary journey. Acts 16:2 in the easy-to-read version states of Timothy, "The believers in the cities of Lystra and Iconium had only good things to say about him." How did Lois influence and mentor Timothy? We can only speculate, but 2 Timothy 3:14 to 15 helps us. "Continue in what you have learned and found to be true. You know who your teachers were. From infancy, you have known the Holy Scriptures." By example and word, Lois helped form the character of her grandson, starting when Timothy was just a baby. The result of her effort, Timothy accompanied Paul on 2 missionary journeys and personally represented Paul on occasions when they had to temporarily split up. Paul grew so fond of Timothy, he considered Timothy his own son. And Paul cited Timothy's rare character in Philippians 2:20 to 22. Here's how the voice puts this: "There is no one like Timothy. What sets him apart from others is his deep concern for you and your spiritual journey. This is rare, my friends, for most people only care about themselves, not about what is dear to the heart of Jesus. You know Timothy is genuine in the Lord's ways." Besides the 2 personal letters written to Timothy from Paul, references to Timothy are found in 9 other New Testament books. Just like Lois, grandparents today should instruct and be a godly example for their grandchildren. Unlike Lois, a different grandparent in the Bible not only failed to teach scriptures to his family, he also set a terrible example for his grandchild. Consider the house of Omri, as detailed in 1 Kings 16:25 to 27. The voice reads, "Omri committed evil in the Eternal's eyes. He was more wicked than any wicked king who had lived before him, and there were a lot of wicked kings who lived before him." 2 examples of wicked kings before Omri were Baasha, who was so evil that God destroyed his family so he'd have no descendants, and Jeroboam, who renounced the Levitical priesthood, allowed anyone to be a priest, and demanded Israel worship golden idols. Going back to 1 Kings 16, now verse 26. Omri embraced the wicked path of Jeroboam, causing the Israelites to live sinful lives. Their worthless gods caused the wrath of the eternal God of Israel, to boil. Is not the rest of Omri's story, his actions demonstrating his might and lasting legacy, documented in the book of the Chronicles of Israel's Kings? Before commenting on Omri's lasting legacy, consider the lives of his son Ahab and his grandson Ahaziah. What was Ahab like? Omri on steroids. Omri died prior to completing the construction of the city of Samaria. Ahab finished it, including a temple to Baal and a pole to Asherah. During his reign, Ahab tried to eliminate all the true prophets of God, including Elijah, who Ahab reviled as the biggest troublemaker in Israel. 1 Kings 16:33 gives Ahab this distinction. He did more to make the Lord God of Israel furious than all the kings of Israel who came before him. And remember, his father, Omri, made God's blood boil. Ahaziah, son of Ahab and grandson of Omri, continued the government of unrighteousness. 1 Kings 22:52-53 summarized his life. The Good News Translation reads, Ahaziah sinned against the Lord, following the wicked example of his father Ahab, his mother Jezebel, and King Jeroboam, who had led Israel into sin. He worshipped and served Baal, and like his father before him, he aroused the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel. Ahaziah had no sons, so when he died, so did his family bloodline, just like Baasha. Now, what was Omri's lasting legacy? An odious reputation and an example. Look at this amazing verse from Micah, written about 150 years after Omri's reign and long after Ahab and Ahaziah had died. In making a case against Israel, God indicted them in Micah 6:16. The voice reads, "For you have followed the ways of Omri and all the works of the kingdom of Ahab, and you have followed their paths of wickedness. That is why I can justifiably decimate you." Grandparents teach by the power of example. It can be a good example or not. Consider these contrasting verses, both from the easy-to-read version. Psalm 112, 1-2 says, "Praise the Lord. Great blessings belong to those who fear and respect the Lord, who are happy to do what he commands. Their descendants will be given power on earth. Those who do right will be greatly blessed." Contrast that with Exodus 20, verse 5. "Don't worship or serve idols of any kind, because I, the Lord, am your God. I hate my people worshiping other gods. People who sin against me become my enemies, and I will punish them, and I will punish their children, their grandchildren, and even their great-grandchildren." Which legacy should grandparents want to leave for their families? For me personally, I hope to leave the legacy of a good example that will bless my descendants for generations to come. Point number two is, don't eat yellow snow. That's a line from the Will Ferrell movie, Elf. Colton, now age 7, has mostly outgrown using this, but not totally. What is the meaning of don't eat yellow snow? A brief understanding of the character of Elf will help explain it. Elf was raised in a completely protected environment. He never heard a lie or even knew what a lie was. He was totally trusting of what the adults around him said and was completely innocent. He was an adult child. After quickly explaining Elf's formative years, the movie shifted to show how Elf interacted with the world for the first time. But before leaving home, Elf received some snippets of advice. Words of caution, such as, "Don't eat yellow snow." What is the significance of that phrase? Children have a teachable and trusting spirit, So we have to be careful what we impart to them. We have to teach them there's a right way and a wrong way to do things, including eating snow. When born, children have no knowledge. Their minds are empty slates. It's up to parents and grandparents to inform them about life and about God. We can teach them fables like rabbits that lay eggs in the spring, and fantasy like Santa Claus, and they'll believe it. Or we can teach them truth, that the Creator of the universe personally knows them and will be their lifelong friend. Psalm 139 gives an indication of how much God values children. Here's verse 16 from the God's Word version. Your eyes saw me when I was still an unborn child. Every day of my life was recorded in your book before one of them had taken place. Verses 17 and 18 show that God's concern continues for us throughout our lives. How precious are your thoughts concerning me, O God. How vast in number they are. If I try to count them, there would be more of them than there are grains of sand. When I wake up, I'm still with you. Teaching truth to our children and grandchildren is a serious responsibility, as Matthew 18 explains. Jesus said, if you mislead these little ones, he'd hold it against us. The Complete Jewish Bible puts verses 6 and 7 of Matthew 18 this way. Whoever ensnares one of these little ones who trust me, it would be better for him to have a millstone hung around his neck and be drowned in the sea. Woe to the world because of snares, for there must be snares, but woe to the person who sets the snare. The Message paraphrases these same verses, adding a little more clarity. But if you give them a hard time bullying or taking advantage of their simple trust, you'll soon wish you hadn't. You'd be better off dropped in the middle of a lake with a millstone around your neck, doomed to the world for giving these God-believing children a hard time. Hard times are inevitable, but you don't have to make it worse. The New King James Life Application Study Bible says this in part about verses 6 and 7. Children are trusting by nature. They trust adults, and through that trust, their capacity to trust God grows. God holds parents and other adults, like grandparents, who influence young children, accountable for how they affect these little ones' ability to trust. As leaders, parents, and grandparents, we are to help young people or new believers avoid anything or anyone that could cause them to stumble in their faith and lead them to sin. We must never take lightly the spiritual education and protection of the young in age and in the faith. Isn't that what Jesus did with his children in the faith, the disciples? Didn't he give them snippets of caution when he first sent them to witness? Matthew 10 is full of advice on how they were to approach the world. Take, for example, just verse 16 from the New King James, which in part says, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. To paraphrase, there's a right way to approach others about the gospel and a wrong way. He urged them to find the balance between wisdom and vulnerability. In a sense, he warned them not to eat yellow snow. Both testaments, the Old and the New, teach there are only two ways to live, God's way or the world's way. For example, from the New Testament, Romans 12:2 says, don't copy the behavior and customs of this world, but let God transform you into a new person by changing the way you think. Then you will learn to know God's will for you, which is good and pleasing and perfect. And this example from the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 30, verses 11 and 19 to 20. This command I am giving you today is not too difficult for you, and it is not beyond your reach. Today I have given you the choice between life and death, between blessings and curses. Now I call heaven and earth to witness the choice you make. Oh, that you would choose life so that you and your descendants might live. You can make this choice by loving the Lord your God, obeying him, and committing yourself firmly to him. This is the key to your life. There's a right way and a wrong way to live, so avoid eating yellow snow. Parents and grandparents have an obligation to teach their children and grandchildren. Psalm 78, verses 2 to 7 says, I will teach you hidden lessons from our past, stories we have heard and known, stories our ancestors handed down to us. We will not hide these truths from our children. We will tell the next generation about the glorious deeds of the Lord, about his power and his mighty wonders. Verse 5, For he issued his laws to Jacob. He gave his instructions to Israel. He commanded our ancestors to teach them to their children, so the next generation might know them, even the children not yet born. And they, in turn, will teach their own children. So each generation should set its hope anew on God, not forgetting his glorious miracles and obeying his commands. Anonymous gets credit for the next statement. When you teach your child, you teach your child's child. Children are teachable and eager to learn, so be careful to always teach them truth, to avoid eating yellow snow. Point number 3 comes from a moment during the summer of 2013. We had the boys for the day and were well past the time we were supposed to take them home. I asked Colton when he wanted to leave, and he said, when the fun's over. Unlike points 1 and 2, there's no need to explain the significance or meaning of that statement. Children naturally know how to have fun. An article, How Often Do You Laugh a Day?, states, preschool-age children don't have to be told to laugh. They laugh naturally and a lot more often than adults do. In fact, a study has shown that children laugh about 400 times a day as compared to adults who laugh 17 times a day. What happens as children age? Why do they lose the ability to laugh and have fun? Life happens, stress, responsibility, and Satan. After all, it's Satan's world at the moment. Satan hates man, the image of God. Satan hates family, the reason God made man. So why would Satan want to allow something healthy for man and the family, like fun and laughter, to thrive? Satan's idea of fun is outlined in Proverbs 1:11. Suppose they say, come with us. We'll ambush somebody and kill him. We'll waylay some harmless soul just for fun. There's good fun and there's bad fun. As leaders, parents, and grandparents, we're tasked with stimulating our children to discern the difference. One example of fun in the Bible stresses the interaction of grandparents with grandchildren. I suggest the Sabbath and holy days, and specifically the Feast of Tabernacles. In Leviticus 23:4, God instructed Moses, in addition to the Sabbath, these are the Lord's appointed festivals, the official days for holy assembly that are to be celebrated at their proper times each year. Some other words for festival are commemoration, feast, gala, jubilee, and treat. And other words for celebrate are glorify, cheer, acclaim, laud, and rhapsodize, or praise with enthusiasm and emotion. You would consciously have to decide not to have fun if you were at a festival and celebrating. How do grandparents affect grandchildren during God's festivals and the feast? Consider how this quote from authors Charles and Ann Morse ties into Leviticus 23:41 and 43, which I'll read in a moment. Here's the quote. The history of our grandparents is remembered not with rose petals, but in the laughter and tears of their children and grandchildren. It is into us that the lives of grandparents have gone. It is in us that their history becomes a future. Now Leviticus 23:41. You must observe this festival to the Lord for 7 days every year. This is a permanent law for you, and it must be observed in the appointed month from generation to generation. And this will remind each new generation of Israelites that I made their ancestors live in shelters when I rescued them from the land of Egypt. If taught, the history of grandparents will pass from children to grandchildren from generation to generation. The New King James Life Application Study Bible has these comments about Leviticus 23 and the feast. The Feast of Tabernacles was a special celebration involving the whole family. Like Passover, this feast taught family members of all ages about God's nature and what He had done for them, and was a time of renewed commitment to God. Our families also need rituals of celebrations to renew our faith and pass it on to our children. The God of the Bible encourages joy. God does not intend for religion to be only meditation and introspection. He also wants us to celebrate. Serious reflection and immediate confession of sin is essential, of course. But this should be balanced by celebrating who God is and what He has done for His people. Leviticus 23:40 ends with the command, "Then celebrate with joy before the Lord your God for 7 days." Deuteronomy 14 addresses the principle of second tithe, as well as partial instructions as to what celebrate means. Verse 26 instructs, "You may use the money to buy any kind of food you want, cattle, sheep, goats, wine, or alcoholic drink. Then feast there in the presence of the Lord your God, and celebrate with your household." How could you not have fun at the feast? Feasts today include socials, dances, youth day, family day, seniors' lunches, meals together, activities. Best of all, we get spiritual food to sustain and inspire us until the next feast. In 2014, Marlo and I had a new experience at the feast in Kauai. We were blessed to be with our grandchildren during most of the feast. Although they didn't attend services, we were together with them for multiple meals, time around the pool, swimming and picnicking at Poipu Beach for family day, and for the church luau. It was fun to see the feast through their eyes, and time will tell if seeing it through our eyes had any effect on them. One interesting interaction occurred at the family spa of our hotel complex. Several church children were in the water when we arrived, and shortly 4-year-old Carson asked them, "What are you going to dress up for at Halloween?" They promptly and politely told Carson that they didn't keep that day. And then our 6-year-old Colton piped up as if speaking for the church children, "But they do keep Passover and Pentecost and the Feast of Trumpets." So Marlo and I have had some impact on our grandchildren. Grandparents and grandchildren have a unique relationship, one that can be especially enjoyed under the umbrella of the feast. Gene Parrott, writer and producer of such shows as The Carol Burnett Show in 1967 and Love American Style in 1969, wrote, "What a bargain grandchildren are. I give them my loose change, and they give me $1 million worth of pleasure." Teach grandchildren the right kind of fun, and that investment could pay dividends for generation after generation. A fourth thing that Colton said happened when we were seated at AMC waiting for the movie Dolphin Tale 2 to begin. As he bit into a piece of chicken tender, his front tooth came out. For days, his tooth was loose, and he knew it could happen at any moment. And when it did, he was totally excited, showing it to us, showing us the space it had filled, telling us how he couldn't wait to tell his parents. After several minutes, as he started to calm down, he said, "I lost my tooth. I'm at the movies. This afternoon, I'm going fishing with my dad. Could this day get any better?" Right at that moment, Colton was exhibiting uninhibited, spontaneous thankfulness. God inspired Paul to write that thankfulness is required of Christians. 1 Thessalonians 5:18 states, "Be thankful in all circumstances, for this is God's will for you who belong to Christ Jesus." Such an approach to God is unique and very rare, as Paul explained in Romans 1:20-21. "For ever since the world was created, people have seen the earth and sky. Through everything God made, they can clearly see His invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature, so they have no excuse for not knowing God. Yes, they knew God, but they wouldn't worship Him or even give Him thanks." Paul, in his second letter to Timothy, pointed out that a prevailing attitude of ingratitude would be a sign of the end. Verses 1 and 2 of chapter 3 say, "You should know this, Timothy, that in the last days there will be difficult times. For people will love only themselves and their money. They will be boastful and proud, scoffing at God, disobedient to parents, and ungrateful." Here's a quick example. See if you can tell what's wrong. A grandparent, trying to be generous to a little boy, gave him an orange. The boy's mother immediately prompted her son, "What'd he say?" The boy shrugged his shoulders, handed the orange back, and demanded, "Peel it." Was the boy thankful or ungrateful? From where will children learn the difference? Moses gave the answer in Deuteronomy 4. Moses reminded the Hebrews of some of the events they experienced since leaving Egypt. They actually heard the voice of God speaking from a great fire. God personally brought them out of Egypt by means of trials, miraculous signs, wonders, war, a strong hand, a powerful arm, and terrifying acts. With God's miracles in mind, Moses cautioned the people in verses 9 and 10. But watch out. Be careful never to forget what you yourself have seen. Do not let these memories escape from your mind as long as you live. And be sure to pass them on to your children and grandchildren. Never forget the day when you stood before the Lord your God at Mount Sinai, where he told me, "Summon the people before me, and I will personally instruct them. Then they will learn to fear me as long as they live, and they will teach their children to fear me also." Just like my first 3 points, God holds parents and grandparents responsible for what children learn. The New King James Life Application Study Bible characterized the Hebrews of Exodus as ungrateful. They hadn't heard and certainly didn't apply the adage, "Gratitude turns what we have into enough." A United Church of God article entitled "Thankfulness and Gratitude" identified Satan as the source of ingratitude. Satan lived at the throne of God but was ungrateful. It wasn't enough. He wanted to usurp God and then be God. When he was cast out of heaven and relegated to the earth, he made sure to broadcast his spirit of ingratitude to Adam and Eve, and every human since. The people of the Exodus displayed that wrong spirit so often and so completely that God deemed them incorrigible. Depending on the translation, God called the Hebrews ingratitude and complaining wicked and evil. As a result, God prevented them from entering the promised land. Except for Joshua and Caleb, who God said had a different attitude than the others, all of the adults over age 20, parents and grandparents, died in the wilderness. It's vital for parents and grandparents to have, display, and teach that different attitude of Joshua and Caleb. Sonia Liu Bumirsky, an eminent researcher at the University of California, Riverside, wrote in her book, The How of Happiness, that expressing gratitude is a component of happiness. She believes the average person can nurture, acquire, and learn happy habits. The foremost way to begin, she says, is to say thank you. Not just for the big things in life, but especially for the little everyday things, like an orange given as an act of kindness, a smile, or an itch you can actually reach. Gratitude helps us to be content and not complain. It focuses us on what we have rather than what we don't have. Eric Hoffer, author and recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, wrote, "The hardest arithmetic to master is that which enables us to count our blessings. The math of thankfulness needs to be taught and applied daily." David wrote in Psalms 92, 1-2, "What a beautiful thing, God, to give thanks, to sing an anthem to you, the high God, to announce your love each daybreak, sing your faithful presence all through the night. How different would our lives be if we counted our blessings every day and then, realizing how much we have, spontaneously expressed Colton's question, 'Could this day get any better?'" I'm going to end this point with a poem by an unknown author. It's titled, "Be Thankful." Be thankful that you don't already have everything you desire. If you did, what would there be to look forward to? Be thankful when you don't know something, for it gives you the opportunity to learn. Be thankful for difficult times. During those times, you grow. Be thankful for your limitations, because they give you opportunities for improvement. Be thankful for each new challenge, because it will build your strength and character. Be thankful for your mistakes. They will teach you valuable lessons. Be thankful when you're tired and weary, because it means you've made a difference. It's easy to be thankful for the good things. A life of rich fulfillment comes to those who are also thankful for the setbacks. Gratitude can turn a negative into a positive. Find a way to be thankful for your troubles, and they can become your blessings. In addition to this poem, Anonymous also recorded, "Grandparents are a delightful blend of laughter, caring deeds, and wonderful stories and love. It's with those special attributes that grandparents can inspire grandchildren to understand and express thankfulness." As I was preparing this sermon on the role of grandparents in the family, based on comments my grandchildren said that made me smile, I wondered if there had been times when I said something spiritually innocent that made God smile. Have I ever given God a moment when he would nudge Jesus and say, "That's my boy, did you hear what he just said?" I hope so. Grandparents have an important family role. God designed families that way. After all, God's all about family. I've shown four ways grandparents can influence their families, and particularly their grandchildren. Do you believe in Disneyland? Set an example of a life centered around God. Don't eat yellow snow. Be truthful. When the fun's over, impart a lifestyle of godly enjoyment. Can this day get any better? Show how to appreciate every moment of life. Grandparents possess a wealth of experience, a treasury of stories, and an abundance of empathy. So they're perfectly suited to help grandchildren imitate good behavior, recognize truth, enjoy healthy fun, and identify reasons for thankfulness. What finer legacy could a grandparent leave than to help a grandchild learn about God and God's way of life? What a privilege that is.